I want to talk about the history of the air, or rather, the history of our relations to the air. Those relations have taken a change, it seems to me, over the last 100 or 200 years. For it seems we have taken to the air, and in at least three different ways. Firstly, we have taken to the air as an arena of inquiry. During the last four centuries or so, the air has been so intensely and systematically subject to observation, experiment, and speculation. It's not as though human beings had been wholly inattentive to the air before that time, for the air had, of course, pervaded all aspects of human life: ritual, mythological, medical, agricultural, technological. Nevertheless, during the period of what we can call scientific modernity, we have taken to the air in our tendency to take the air as an object of scientific, technical, and philosophical concern. Secondly, though, we've taken to the air in the sense in which we might say a walker takes to the road, or a duck takes to water, or any other creature to its native element. Our understanding of the air has allowed us increasingly to occupy it in ways that had previously been possible only in dream. But now the air is literally occupied in air travel by many different conveyances, from balloons to jet planes, in the exploration of space, which requires the traversal of and re-entry into the atmosphere, in radio, TV, and other electromagnetic signals carried through the air, and in the use of X-rays and other forms of radioactivity. Our occupation of the air has even extended temporally backwards and forwards through the investigation of climate patterns and measurements that allow us to make sensitive forecasts of the weather and even to some small degree to control it. The fact that we can abstract and even manufacture our own supplies of air and to maintain artificial climates enables us to live in portions of the earth where the enmity of the air would otherwise prevent human habitation. And we're able even to travel out of the air altogether into the oceans and beyond the atmosphere, and to maintain artificial climates enabling this. Can man live elsewhere than in air? Asks the philosopher Luce Irigaray. Well, one sees what she means, but the answer must be now decidedly yes. We can say the thin air has become unignorably thick for us because thick with us. Where, for the tens of thousands of years that there have been humans, these creatures have been humble, humilis, of the earth, earthy, scuttling around on the ground floor of an unsuspected ocean of air, with occasional feeble aspirations to shin a tree or scale a peak, in the last three or four centuries we have certainly made a habitation of the air. If we're still some way short of being post-human, we've certainly for some time been posthumous. And this leads me to the third sense in which we may be said to have taken to the air. For, occupying the air as much as we do, and occupied with the air as we so much are, we've begun to find the air more and more expressive of our nature and condition. In seeking to understand our physical composition and that of our world, we have turned to air. We know our bodies, minds, and social forms and communications increasingly through its light mirror. Human beings have always believed themselves to be in part airy, and have often wanted to believe that their most essential part, their spirits, as they've liked to call them, were airy form. And yet, in their clinging humility, human beings have viewed the idea of a literal translation into an airy condition with some suspicion. For airiness also tends to signify delusion, insignificance, even madness. When Marx and Engels declared that under capitalism all that is solid melts into air, they were being prescient but not at all approving. Others, though, more recently, have been inclined to accept this change not as a degradation, but as a fundamental evolution in the system of human relations, although one that might require us to think anew about what we meant by foundations and fundaments. The philosopher Michel Serres notes that the systems matter has changed phase. We are more liquid than solid, more air-like than liquid, more informational than material. The global is fleeing towards the fragile, the weightless, the living, the breathing. Michel Serre has formulated this insight in a number of different ways over the last 10 or 15 years. In a remarkable chapter from his 1994 book Atlas, entitled in French Temps du Monde, signifying both the time of the world and the weather of the world, Serre proposes that we make out from the turbulence of meteorology a metaphor or a kind of map for the movements of information. We inhabit, he suggests, a kind of informational weather in which the atlas is the territory or the aeritory. The physics of solids with their clearly defined edges and outlines seem scarcely appropriate even to the era of thermodynamics in the 19th century, let alone that of the movement of information. But the physics of gaseous, aerial or viscous states of matter offer an image which can make concrete the forms that information takes. Another philosopher, the German Peter Sloterdijk, has echoed some of these arguments in the third volume of his huge philosophical trilogy Sphären, or Spheres. The third volume is entitled Schäume, or Foams. Discussing the work in an interview, he declared that all previous natural languages, including theoretical discourse, were developed for a world of weight and solid substances. They are thus incapable of expressing the experiences of a world of lightness and relations. Because of their Marxist heritage, critical theorists succumb to the realistic temptation of interpreting the light as appearance and the heavy as essence. Therefore, they practice criticism in the old style, in that they expose the lightness of appearance in the name of the heaviness of the real. In reality, I think that it's through the occurrence of abundance in the modern that the heavy has turned into appearance, and the essential now dwells in lightness, in the air, in the atmosphere. The German philosopher Peter Sloterdijk. Sloterdijk's trilogy reads human history, philosophical, religious, artistic, political, as the successive elaboration of three different kinds of spheres or spaces of introversion. His first volume concentrates on what he calls microspherology, the construction of intimate and elementary spheres, typified by the simplest closed dyadic relations between the child and the womb or the child and the mother. His second volume follows through the macrospherological evolution of larger, more inclusive and metaphysical spheres, typified in imperial conceptions of the one world or the idea of the global village. His third volume proposes, by contrast, that the modern world must be understood now non-holistically, in terms of what he calls a polyspherology, which will take account in a multifocal, multiperspectival and heterarchical manner of the complex aggregations of different spheres that make up the world. Where the governing metaphor for microspherology in Sloterdijk's first volume is the bubble, and the governing metaphor of macrospherology in his second volume is the globe, the aptest and most versatile metaphor for the polyspherological condition of the modern world is that of foam. This, Sloterdijk describes as an assemblage of assemblages, a semi-opaque foam of world-making constructions of space. Such a system is characterized by lightness, fragility, ephemerality. Foams are never permanent and always in a state of evolution and devolution. Sloterdijk follows through the many mixed traditions relating to foam. On the one hand, the foamy, defined as air in an unexpected place, in a parody of Mary Douglas's definition of dirt as matter out of place, the foamy then signifies the aberrant, the anomalous, even sometimes the diabolical. Dreams, fantasies and delusions are frothy in that they are almost nothing and yet not nothing. This is much better in Sloterdijk's German, fast nichts und doch nicht nichts. But Sloterdijk acknowledges an alternative tradition in which foaminess is seen as generative. For example, in Hesiod's account of the birth of Aphrodite from the waves, which proposes an etymology of her name as foam-born, from Greek aphros, meaning foam. This alternative tradition, which is evidenced in the prominence of oceanic churning in many cosmogonies and stays alive through Aristotle's account of the spermatic foam of semen and the central value accorded to fermentation in alchemy, would suggest the contrary belief that, far from being diabolical, all creation owes its being to the fecundating powers of foam. Sloterdijk proposes that the modern world requires what he calls an aphrology, his name for the theory of co-fragile systems. Indeed, his emphasis through foams is on the new responsiveness to this polyspheric fragility which characterizes philosophical, artistic, and industrial modernity, in which fragility must be thought as the location and the mode of that which is most real. For the philosopher Michel Serre, it is the turbulence of clouds and vortexes which allows a grasping of the universal, which a metaphysics of the solid cannot access. For Peter Sloterdijk, by contrast, the polycameral, foamy condition of the modern world ensures that there are no exits into the all. Indeed, for Sloterdijk, the attention paid to all those things that had constituted the atmospheric, the given, the implicit, the unmarked, the immaterial, the merely given, are typified by the air, which is always, or always has been, simply and unconsciously there to be respired and traversed. Sloterdijk sees us involved in a form of making explicit, explizieren, as he calls it in German, which we might translate as explicitation. For Peter Sloterdijk, the real foundation of modernity is not revolution, as is so often said, but explicitation. And he proposes that the whole of modernity can be characterized by just such a principle, according to which whatever had previously lain in the background as a mere given or assumed form of existence is brought forcibly into view, its principles unfolded, its possibilities actualized. And Sloterdijk sees the most important and the most decisive arena of explicitation as occurring with respect to the air. This is because our relation to the air is the feature of our embodied life that is most taken for granted. The atmosphere is therefore, in a sense, the implicit as such. And what's more, Sloterdijk is willing to assign a date to the point at which the process of explicitation became permanent and irreversible. The date is the 22nd of April, 1915. And it marks the first use of chlorine gas in the hostilities of the First World War by German forces against French-Canadian troops positioned near Ypres. The significance of this lay in the fact that for the first time, the target of a weapon in war was not the body of an assailant, but rather his environment. The assailant exploited the possibility of making the continued existence of his enemy impossible by immersing him for a period in a milieu incapable of supporting life. After its inaugurating moment, what Peter Sloterdijk calls this atmo-terrorism continues to escalate after the First World War through the industrial use of gas for extermination of insect pests, the judicial use of gas as a means of execution in the USA, the use of Zyklon B for the murder of huge numbers of Jews in the concentration camps, the manufacture of annihilating firestorms in Dresden, and the effects of radioactivity following Hiroshima and Nagasaki, all the way through to more recent attempts to take control of the weather for military purposes. Truly, it seems, we've entered the epoch of what might be called air conditioning. Universal air conditioning, in which the literal air becomes representative of all the atmospheres and environments in general in which life has previously subsisted without conscious awareness and of which we must now necessarily be anxiously conscious. Perhaps this process of explicitation has a longer history than Peter Sloterdijk acknowledges. It certainly seems to be true that the air has often been thought to be more elusive, intractable, and intangible than the other elements because of its invisibility and the consequent obliquity of its signs and appearances. Unlike the other ancient elements, the air has always had to be inferred, and so may be regarded as uniquely lacking in objecthood or explicitness in contrast with those other elements. There always seems to be something in the air, something yet to be made out behind its appearances. The other side of this is that, as a consequence, the air can only ever be known at second hand. In this sense, the air is nothing but its appearances and articulations, and is therefore the most, so to speak, exterior of the elements. It's exterior to itself. It seems to have, in a sense, no inside. Seen in this light, it doesn't call to be disclosed or made manifest, since disclosure and making manifest are all it's got and everything it is. Although its protean nature makes it difficult to treat the air as a simple object, something that can be made to stand simply before us, like earth or water, its very capriciousness lends it the capacity to be treated like a power or agency, which is to say something capable of and tending towards self-exteriorization. The quality of an agent is that, through its own actions, it comes into appearance and effect. Earth and water may be regarded as endlessly regenerative, but they nevertheless simply are. The air, by contrast, and its intensified form, fire, ceaselessly come to be. It's precisely this being in becoming that has encouraged so many human cultures, and indeed other creatures, to harness the powers of the air and to turn them to account. The earliest known design of a windmill comes from Persia and dates between 900 and 500 before Christ. But windmills may have been in use in China for 4,000 years. Windmills, used not just for grinding grain but for pumping water, were central to the technology and politics of medieval Europe. Meanwhile, sails have been in use to power boats since 3200 BC in Egypt. By 1000 AD, Vikings had explored large areas of the North Atlantic by sail. These are only the most direct and the far-reaching captures and applications of the mobile air. Both sailing and milling required careful observation of the powers and properties of air, which rendered those powers finite, specific, and directed rather than general. And this is to leave out of account all the indirect ways in which the air was brought into practical knowledge, and that knowledge deployed to predict the weather, to effect cures, to sustain good health, and even to ensure the success of buildings. Wherever and whenever one looks, it seems, the air has always been being particularized, partitioned, apportioned, deported from itself, conditioned. There is perhaps no date to which one can assign the beginning of air conditioning. In traditional understandings, the air was ubiquitous, but essentially plural. It's perhaps for this reason that the air has not been conceptualized as the other elements have in many cultures and systems of thought. Hebrew had no single, all-encompassing word for air in all its aspects, and in this it resembled Sumerian. Although there is a Sumerian god of the air, Enlil, there is no term for the air at rest in Sumerian or in Akkadian. All the terms in these languages, in fact, denoting various kinds of motion, wind, storm, etc. Air is not to be found among the elements in the earliest Indian texts. Nor does the air feature among the five elements, wood, fire, earth, metal, and water, discriminated by classic Chinese texts, such as the Tao Te Ching from the 6th century BC. The air was clearly identified as an element by pre-Socratic philosophers in Greece. Indeed, Anaximenes, writing in the 6th century BC, made it the original out of which all matter was made. Nevertheless, there was in Greek thought a strong tendency to see the air as multiple rather than singular in form. Indeed, its conception of the air was, as it were, distributed between two words, the ether, the realm of brightness above the clouds, and the air, the dim, moist atmosphere below them. So, more than any other element, the air's essence is to be dissimulated into its different aspects, accidents, and appearances, as breath, wind, height, space, transparency, lightness, light. The essential plurality of the air explains why Aristotle could be so emphatic in his arguments, in his book Meteorology, against what seemed to him